The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program is sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Good evening and welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of all times, the pro-life movement. This evening, we continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight, we will feature a presentation from our 2024 convention. Our speakers' ideas will inspire you with principles, experiences, and wisdom as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. I am pleased to introduce to you Dr. David A. Prentice, former Vice President of the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He is also a former advisory board chair and a founding member of the Midwest Stem Cell Therapy Center, a comprehensive stem cell center in Kansas. In 2020, he was appointed by the Secretary of Human Health and Services to the Federal Human Fetal Tissue Ethics Advisory Board. Dr. Prentice has almost 50 years of experience as a scientific researcher and professor and is an internationally recognized expert on stem cell research, cell biology, and bioethics. He has provided scientific lectures and policy briefings in 40 states and 21 countries, including testimony before the U.S. Congress and numerous state legislatures, the U.S. National Academy of Science, the U.S. President's Council on Bioethics, numerous European parliaments, the United Nations, and the Vatican. He was selected by President George W. Bush's U.S. President's Council on Bioethics to write the comprehensive review of adult stem cell research for their publication, Monitoring Stem Cell Research. He established Stem Cell Research Facts, an educational website about adult stem cells, is a founding member of Do No Harm, the Coalition of Americans for Research Ethics, and is an advisory board for the Central for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Among his many awards is the 2007 Walter C. Randall Award in Biomedical Ethics from the American Psychological Society. Dr. Prentice has reviewed for various professional publications and has been interviewed in virtually all major media outlets.
Well, thank you all so much. And I wanted to point out a couple of things in full disclosure. That's a PhD, not an MD, which the young daughter of one of my colleagues reminded him, it's not the kind of doctor that can do you any good. The other thing, that, and as Bob noted, professor, old professor, so I've had them lock the door so you can't escape as we go to the science lecture. There will not be a final exam. Okay. So, but I do want to educate you. And it's going to be what some of my colleagues call weird science, but some of it is very good science. And there's a lot of terms that get thrown around. Stem cells, just generically, are they good, are they bad, are they both, are they neither? Well, we'll talk about some of that and some other things, but to try and get you up to speed on some of the challenges, as I call them, that we're facing now beyond just killing babies in the womb. We're actually at the point where we're killing them even before they get to the womb, or using them for experiments, or parting out young human beings, nascent human beings, as the title said. So I don't want you to be like Calvin here. He says, aren't you supposed to be doing your homework now? Well, I quit doing homework. Homework is bad for my self-esteem. It sends the message, I don't know enough. All that emphasis on right answers makes me feel bad when I get them wrong. So instead of trying to learn, I'm just concentrating on liking myself the way I am. And Hobbes goes, well, so your self-esteem is enhanced by remaining an ignoramus? Please, let's call it informationally impaired. I don't want you to be informationally impaired. So this one you all know. So you get an A. Human life begins at fertilization. Technically, sperm-egg fusion, that moment. Dr. Lyle and some others have shown you visual proof of various things going on here, but wanted to reference a couple of scriptures as well. In the image of God has God made man, from Genesis, and from Psalm 139, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. There's another part of Psalm 139 that says, your eyes beheld my unformed substance. I had a Hebrew scholar say, you can translate that word as embryo. Your eyes beheld my embryo, the nascent human beings we're talking about. Science backs this up. I mean, all of this debate about, oh, when does life begin? Science has already settled that question. Dr. Maureen Kondik has written a tome, a huge book about it. But I want to direct your attention to the quote at the bottom from O'Rahilly. O'Rahilly is a renowned embryologist who, back in the 1940s, put together what are called the Carnegie stages of development, recognized by embryologists around the world since then as the definitive stages of early human development. And O'Rahilly has said prenatal age begins at fertilization. Your postnatal age begins at birth. Nature, a scientific journal that's one of the two leading journals in the world, in the upper left there, your destiny from day one. Whoops. They actually admitted it. From day one, from the moment of fertilization. And in the lower right are those Carnegie stages that O'Rahilly developed. For your first 8 weeks of development, parting out each staged what you looked like at that very early nascent stage of life. So let's ask the question, so who are these nascent human beings? Well, we've already answered that question. Sperm-egg fusion happens, you're now a human being. You're not just a cell or a clump of cells as you go on and develop. You have a complete human genome, which is the biological definition of human being, a member of our species. The sperm-egg fusion activates the egg. You're now a single-cell organism. Organism being the key thing here. You're not just a cell anymore. You are a being. Where do you find nascent human beings? Well, in pregnant women. We kind of all guessed that one, didn't we? But also places nowadays like assisted reproductive technology or IVF clinics, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, as well as science research labs and biotech laboratories. So the darker side of science here. And are nascent human beings actually different from mature human beings? Well, duh. Biologically, yes, our age, our size, our maturity, our functions change as we develop. But we're still human beings, human organisms. In terms of physical privacy, you have none federally. Hopefully that will change, especially after the recent Alabama decision and some other things going on. But in terms of your humanness, there is no difference whether I am 1 day old, 1 month old, or 100 years old. So let's talk a little bit about IVF. The first IVF baby, Louise Brown, born in 1978, the first IVF baby born in the U.S. in 1981, and since 1978, best estimate is now there have been at least 12 million babies around the world born through this IVF process. But what you may not know is there were at least 100 million IVF embryos created that eventually led to those 12 million or so babies. Somewhere around 90% of IVF embryos created never make it to birth. Many are put into the freezer, but most of them are just discarded or destroyed. In the IVF clinic, they actually go through and grade you. And if you're top grade, okay, you've got a chance of getting put in the womb. If you're a lesser grade human being, think about that phrase itself, you may be discarded or given away for scientific research. And there are problems even with those who got the top grade and were implanted and gestated. Research is starting to come out more and more lately that there are risks for the babies as well as for mom going through that IVF process, being made in a laboratory dish, even being frozen and then thawed, and an increased risk of certain types of cancers or other congenital anomalies. And there's very little protection, as we've met. Actually, some of the best protection is in Germany. Since 1990, they have what's called the Embryo Protection Law. It's against the law in Germany to destroy a human embryo. Wish that were the case here. Now, Germany has slid, but they still have that part of the law in place. They don't actually allow you to freeze a human embryo unless it's to save its life. And what their aim is that all the embryos created in one cycle, supposedly a maximum of three, have to be transferred to the womb. You have to give them a chance for life. In the U.S., Louisiana has the best law so far, where if you're an embryo, and especially even if you're in a freezer, you are what's called a juridical person. You actually have legal protections. Now, since they thaw you out and put you in the womb, you lose all those protections. But at least they are trying to show some respect to the human dignity of these tiny little nascent human beings. And I don't know if you remember during Hurricane Katrina, that picture in the lower right, they actually went in and rescued frozen embryos to save their lives, carted this liquid nitrogen container full of embryos out. Later on, they followed the story of the one embryo that was thawed, and they named him Noah. And, of course, the recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling, the main point of that was it recognized the biological fact. These are little nascent human beings, and they deserve the protection of the law. Well, other things that can happen to little nascent human beings, a bunch of them coming up to the pearly gates, St. Peter goes partial birth abortion, no, stem cell research. But what kind of stem cells? Embryonic stem cells. Where do you get embryonic stem cells? From embryos. You've created embryos, whether through the IVF process or actually intentionally for research purposes in the lab, and they are destroyed in the lab. Their cells taken, put into the culture dish. You grow them. You can do all sorts of experiments with them, but you have to keep in mind that where do you get embryonic stem cells? You get them from the destruction of nascent human beings. No two ways about it. You have to kill a young human being to get embryonic stem cells. And just to reiterate the source of those embryonic stem cells, this is from a House of Representatives hearing in 2001. I was testifying, but you know they weren't interested in the geek scientists. Here were the stars, the Borden family. So Lucinda was testifying, talking about how they had adopted some frozen embryos. And she held up this picture of the little embryos under the microscope, those little balls of cells. And then John stood up behind her with Luke and Mark in his arms and said, "So which of my sons would you kill for research?" And you could have heard a pin drop in that hearing room. And then they sent me this picture of Luke and Mark recently, 19 years later. One's now becoming a policeman, one's going into the Marines. These are the sources of human embryonic stem cells. You have to kill a living human being to get them. There's another kind of stem cell you might have heard of, but if not, it's called induced pluripotent stem cells. Okay, that's a mouthful. iPS cells. But the idea of this came to a Japanese scientist, Dr. Yamanaka, a number of years ago, and he actually got the Nobel Prize in 2012 for doing it. But the quote at the top is from a New York Times interview where they're saying, "Where'd you come up with this?" And he says, "Well, when I saw the embryo, I suddenly realized there was such a small difference between it and my daughter's. Friend had had him over to the lab to look through the microscope, and he goes, "We can't keep destroying embryos for research. There must be another way." And he came up with this. The way you make induced pluripotent stem cells or iPS cells, you can take just an average cell off the street, skin cell, let's say. You add some factors to it, and it's like reprogramming a computer. You reprogram the cell so that it now looks and acts like an embryonic stem cell. But there are no embryos involved. Nobody had to die to get these cells. And in fact, you can make them from virtually anybody. You can make them from people that have diseases and study the disease in the dish and so on. Another good reason that he did get the Nobel Prize for doing that. Now, there are lots of stem cells. There are even stem cells in plants. And, of course, he's going, "I think we injected you with the wrong stem cell." But the one I want to turn to next are what we call adult stem cells. Now, there are lots of sources from our own bodies, as well as from umbilical cord blood and the solid part of the cord and the placenta for adult stem cells. So if you look around there, those are not all of the sources, but you might see one that's my favorite in the kind of upper right, the dark blue adipose or fat tissue. I figure I can be a donor now. But you can get these adult stem cells again, number one, without killing anybody, without harming a single human being, and you can use them to treat disease, unlike embryonic stem cells. Bone marrow transplants are adult stem cell transplants. Umbilical cord blood and the solid part of the cord can be used to transplant to treat a number of different types of diseases. And in fact, the paper at the top was up to the year 2016, 1.5 million people around the globe successfully treated with adult stem cells. By now, it's well over 2 million, and for lots and lots of different conditions. Now, a lot of it's still experimental. Can't go down to your local clinic and get all of these, but I wanted to walk you through some of them where we've documented from the patients themselves the success of their treatment, and you can find these and other stories at stemcellresearchfacts.org. You go there, and we have the patients tell their story instead of some geek scientist. It's a little more compelling. The little cutie there to the right, Reagan Moore, was diagnosed at birth with what's called Krabbe syndrome. It's a neurological genetic problem, but they diagnosed her right away, and they gave her umbilical cord blood transplant. Now, Krabbe's usually, the little kids are dead by the time they're 2 years old. Reagan started going to school about a year or so ago. She's still alive and growing and kicking and just a ball of fire. So look up her story. We actually did an update recently of her story. Allison Carr, treated for multiple sclerosis. She no longer has multiple sclerosis. Barry Brown was an Air Force drill instructor, had a heart attack, and was told he basically couldn't do any more exercise. That almost killed him, hearing that news. He got an adult stem cell transplant, and 6 months after his transplant ran a half marathon. Caitlin McNamara had a whole new functional bladder created from adult stem cells and transplanted in. Sonia Kuntz had had a stroke as a young adult, was partially paralyzed on one side, her speech was slurred. It was bad enough it was embarrassing for her, and she didn't want to go ahead and get married. So she underwent an adult stem cell transplant where they put them into the site of the stroke in her brain, and she's now married and has two kids. Amazing sorts of recoveries. Like it says, the Stanford researchers were stunned by how well she recuperated. Desiree lived all of her life up until about the age of 21 with pain because of her sickle cell anemia. Umbilical cord blood transplant, no more sickle cell anemia, and she went to school to become a nurse so she could help others. Story about a few people, not a lot at this point, who have been, quotes, cured of HIV after adult stem cell transplants. So basically, there are lots of types of stem cells. The fetal tissue, fetal stem cells, embryonic on the left, involves death of at least one human being to get those cells. On the right, the adult stem cells and even the iPS cells. Nobody dies, and especially for the adult stem cells, these are the ones that work. These are the gold standard when we talk about actually treating patients. Now, in full disclosure, yes, I'm from Kansas. I've been to Ohio a lot. Thank you to Molly for inviting me several times to speak, and I've testified at the State House on a number of things, but I'm from Kansas, and so in Kansas, when Sam Brownback was governor, we ran a bill to put together an adult stem cell center where they could develop new treatments and cures and treat patients called the Midwest Stem Cell Therapy Center. And more of that needs to be done because, again, these are the gold standards to actually help patients. Another thing that's sort of a positive, here's a weird term you might hear, organoid. Now, don't get annoyed at the organoid, but I'll give you a little organoid recital. These are tiny little, they don't necessarily look like the organ. They're not really a mini organ, but they're put together using stem cells, and it's usually adult stem cells or those iPS cells, ethically derived, that you can put together, and they will start to undergo normal development and develop tissues and organs similar to what you would see in the developing human being. So I guess you don't really need fetal tissue and fetal stem cells anymore. It hadn't worked anyway. But you can do those same sorts of studies now on organoids, cerebral organoids, where they will start to grow and develop. And this is how they actually figured out using these types of structures how Zika virus was causing some of the problems with brain development. Lung stem cell alveospheres, but you know, basically miniature lungs showing the growth and development, coming up with ways to look at that, self-assembling heart organoids, photoreceptors that potentially could even be used to restore vision. So you could study them in the dish, but eventually you could transplant them. Nose organoids, and my favorite, tiny little tear glands. Okay, that's Roy Orbison on the right. Can anybody tell me what song I was referring to?
Crying.
Yeah, crying. So when I thought about tear gland organoids, I thought, crying. Anyway, okay, let's turn a little more serious, though, to some other and weirder things that are going on in science, creating and cloning nascent human beings, other ways. They've been very inventive trying to come up with other ways that you might be able to make human beings in the lab for experiments, manipulating them, genome editing, animal-human chimeras, anybody? Oops. Growing, exploiting, taking out organ tissues, parting them out, which we've talked about before, and then even gestating these bioengineered humans for experiments. So this is the newest way to clone a human being. We'll come back later and talk about the Dolly type of cloning. But this is where you take different types of stem cells, and in most cases they're talking about embryonic stem cells now, back to exploiting nascent human beings, mixing them together, and you get these things to start to assemble into what looks like an embryo. Now, they will continue to talk about it's not really an embryo. It's a model of an embryo. It's a synthetic embryo. It's an artificial embryo. We don't want you to think it's a real embryo. But they're getting closer and closer and growing them in the lab. There used to be what's called the 14-day rule, where the scientists swore up and down, yes, I'm not going to grow a human embryo in the lab more than 14 days. I promise, I promise, I promise. And in some countries, like the UK, it's against the law to do it. Well, it was an easy promise to keep because nobody could do it. And then, recently, they started to be able to get closer and closer and up to the limit, whether it was an embryo created by the old-fashioned way, sperm-egg fusion, or some of these newer stem cell-derived, where you mix them together, stir it with a stick, and now you've got an embryo. There's a scientist in Israel who's done this with mouse embryos, and he's got them in these little spinning bottles, and he's been growing them to the point that you start to see the mouse embryo's heartbeat halfway through gestation. And of course, he goes, yeah, I'd like to do that with human embryos too. Let's grow them up to at least 40 days, and then we'll just throw them away. Well, we've been trying to fight back against this and talking about babies in bottles, and you shouldn't get rid of the 14-day limit, but they keep moving along. Again, notice the term synthetic human embryos, model embryos with heartbeats, and these are human embryos or models or artificial. No, they're real embryos. If it looks like an embryo and it acts like an embryo, what do you call it? Right. Detailed lab replicas. What's next? Revisit the 14-day rule. Let's get rid of that. It's kind of cramping our style. We want to grow these longer human embryos. And they did. They dropped it. In fact, now, as long as you can, wink, wink, scientifically justify your experiment, you can grow a human embryo in the lab as long as you like. This group called the International Society for Stem Cell Research, it's sort of a self-elected group that puts out guidance for scientists around the globe on what they should be doing and their, quotes, ethics of doing experiments. So no more 14-day limit, but they also decided you could make these embryo models and do whatever you want with them. We're not going to call them a real embryo. You could grow them in the lab. You could do genetic alteration. You could make human-animal chimera mixes. And you could make three-parent embryos and even gestate them to birth. There's not too much that isn't allowed now under their guidance. But they will continue to claim that, no, we're going to follow the best ethical rules. Don't count on that. Complete human embryos, 14 post-implantation days. In other words, let's just blow by that 14-day limit. Complete models, real embryos. But we're still going to call them a model, so you pro-lifers just stay off our backs, and we'll just come up with something for you. And again, the guy in Israel who then formed a company called Renewal Bio, where they will make, quote, synthetic embryos. Can you say the word clone? And we will grow them, and then we'll harvest the organs from your clone. Whatever you need. Has anybody ever seen the movie The Island? Yeah, this is very similar. I mean, it's the same type of thing of we're going to grow your clone and harvest. And then let's talk about what we are more familiar with human cloning. Not actually this, like the little baby thinks, even though it looks like I'm looking at my clone here. But what we now think of as an older form of cloning, how you got Dolly the sheep. You take an egg, you remove its DNA, its nucleus, and you transfer the nucleus from a body cell, technically what's called a somatic cell. But like a skin cell again, put that into the egg, and now all of your genetic material comes from that skin cell. So if you put the nucleus from my skin cell, that's my clone. You grow it for a while, and then they will talk about two different ways to clone. It's not two different ways, it's two different fates for a cloned embryo. To the left, reproductive cloning, you actually try to implant the embryo in the womb and let him or her grow for a while, hopefully to birth. And they've sworn up and down, no, we're not going to do that, though they still want to. In fact, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine years ago said, well, we're not going to totally close off that because maybe instead of an IVF embryo, we want to grow your clone. Or to the right, the euphemistic therapeutic cloning. That sounds really good. It's not therapeutic for the embryo. The embryo dies. We kill her, we put her cells in the dish, and we do experiments that lead to not a single cure. But, again, this proposal will grow the human clones, we'll use them for spare parts. And since it's a clone, we're not going to consider it a full human being. no legal rights whatsoever. As Dr. Alex Zavorankov says, you would have spare parts for a very long time. We'll just keep growing more clones for you. Let's talk about gene editing. Now, there are actually two forms here, and you need to keep this clear as well. When we talk about genetic engineering or gene editing, the somatic type on the left, there are not really any ethical problems. The idea here is, if I've got some genetic disease, you would take some of my cells, put the new correct gene in to replace a faulty gene, giving my cells back. You're only affecting me, nobody else. And you do it in such a way that I don't pass on any of that genetic material, so not into reproductive cells, versus heritable or germline gene editing. The idea here is you make that sort of genetic swap, but you do it at the very first stages of life, nascent human beings, the egg, the sperm, and especially the very early embryo. So now you don't affect just that individual. That individual can pass that on to her or his progeny. It can go right on through the entire population if you want. The Chinese have actually combined cloning and gene editing. So they tried that heritable gene editing on, it says underlined in the red there, nuclear transfer embryos. That's their euphemism for clones. They made a bunch of cloned human embryos and used them so that they had experimental replicates. So we can, you know, they're all the same. Let's see what happens with 10 out of 100 or 90 out of 100 or whatever. You probably heard about the Chinese researcher a number of years ago who actually did the experiment where he took a couple of little girls as embryos and tried to do genetic editing on them. His supposed theory was he was going to help them not get infected with the HIV virus. He thought he had isolated the right gene. We would mutate that. They'll never get infected with the virus. Well, it turned out it only worked on one of the two little girls. He gestated them to birth. And then they started looking at, well, what other things don't we know or do we know about that gene? So he might have prevented the one little girl from getting HIV, but for both of the little girls, he probably made them more susceptible to West Nile virus, influenza, probably changed their cognitive status and decreased their lifespan. Just a little bit of hubris there. It was bad enough that a number of scientists and ethicists around the world said, hey, we need a moratorium. We shouldn't go ahead and do this. Now, they never actually enacted any moratorium. And in fact, our own National Academy of Science and WHO got together and put together guidance rules not to stop this, not to even look at the ethics, but ways forward. They had 7 guidelines how to make this happen eventually. But they said, you know, ultimately, maybe we can alter embryos for implantation. And instead of doing the grading, hey, you're a grade A, we'll put you in, you're not so good, we take the lower grade embryos and we just genetically alter them so now they can all go in. Three-parent embryos are a version of this genetic engineering. Here, you're going to actually have genetic material from 2 moms, which means you've got to send 2 Mother's Day cards now. But the idea is you're trying to change the little energy factories in the egg. You get all of those called mitochondria from your mom. They have a little bit of DNA. DNA can be mutated, and it can lead to some diseases in some people. But their remedy was to reconstruct embryos at the very earliest stage, to do this genetic engineering so that you would make engineered human beings with DNA from 2 different moms and then add dad's component. We actually were able to get ahead of them in the U.S. and passed a little law that says, no, you can't do this in the U.S. And so the doctor there in the upper part holding the baby went to Mexico to do it. They didn't have any prohibitions against doing these kinds of experiments. Congress has continued to renew that rider, that amendment, since 2015. So there's still protection here, but not in a lot of other countries. Subsequently, somebody actually did the proof of principle experiments and found out you don't really cure that disease by doing that. And then you've got the idea of human-animal chimeras, in this case the first human-monkey hybrid grown in China. There's kind of a theme here, isn't it? China seems to be doing a lot of stuff that gets by the ethical oversight, you might say. But these scientists were making human-monkey hybrids, chimeras, combining human and monkey genetics. Now, the whole idea supposedly is, we've got a shortage of organs, so let's grow human organs in, a monkey or a pig or a goat or something. But they're not being very discerning in terms of how they're doing these experiments. So what if you had a monkey that had a partial human brain? Does that get any legal protection? Well, since we won't protect unborn humans, I doubt it. But the idea that you're pushing this envelope to come up with new species that really do cross ethical lines, and supposedly you're going to have all these great transplants, but that hasn't actually worked out. Artificial wombs have been in the news over the last year. There was a group in Philadelphia, actually, that came up. It's not an artificial womb. It's really just a fancy incubator for extremely premature babies. They were doing these experiments on lambs. It actually worked where you would take the very extreme preemie, hook them up into these little bio bags, give them a sort of gentle circulatory system, and be able to let them stay in this like they're still in the womb for a few more weeks, so their little lungs and some of the other organs can develop. So there's actually a good possibility with this, but they're not ready for human trials. There are a lot of problems with this, and there are a lot of people that are trying to, let's do the whole thing, like the guy in Israel. Let's start with some constructed or manufactured human embryos, and then let's do things along the way, like, which he's already done, combine human-animal cells together to make those embryos. Do genetic engineering. Use those embryos for toxicology studies and so on. So thankfully, last fall the FDA said, this isn't ready for prime time. Go back and do some more work. Now, I put this paper up here. This sounds really good on the surface, right? We need an ethical framework for human embryology with these embryo models, those constructed things. This was put out by a bunch of those folks, the same ones that put out the guidance that you don't need a 14-day limit. And their ethical framework is, pretty much do whatever you want with human embryos, or the models, if we want to call them that, and we're okay with it. As long as you can get good scientific information out of that, we're just not going to call these an embryo until maybe we can get them to birth. So they keep pushing on this, and we need to be pushing back. I like this cartoon because the guys in the lab are going, I find it harder and harder to get any work done with all the ethicists hanging around. But we need more ethicists. We need more people with, frankly, just common sense, because common sense is not so common anymore, especially in some of the scientists that are doing this work. A couple of my colleagues and I put together this set of slides here where we're looking at the bioethical principles that really have held sway forever in terms of the types of research that you should be allowed or shouldn't be allowed to do on any human being, even in the womb and even before the womb. There should be no injury or risk of death to the research subject. There should be full informed consent. It should be scientifically sound research. It's not one of these, I wonder what would happen if, kind of the science fair experiments. There should be some benefit, actually, even if you're in the womb. That's part of what's called common law in federal law. There should be some benefit. And no injury to other human beings, and including societal effects. So what do you do about these nascent human beings, these little tiny embryos no bigger than a dot, identify that this is a nascent human being. Give them the benefit of the doubt, in fact. Well, I'm not sure, but it kind of looks like an embryo, and it acts like an embryo. And by the way, it's got a beating heart, so yeah, we're going to call that an embryo. Look for the possibility of injury or risk of undue death, and evaluate any kind of consent. Now, pop quiz, as a professor, how many unborn babies can give informed consent? Okay. Pretty definitive answer there. And then again, consider the societal effects, even on cloned individuals and so on. The potential medical benefits for society do not outweigh the injuries and risks of death and undue injury for human research subjects. And that includes nascent human beings, two-cell, one-cell embryos, ready to implant, implanted, 1 week, 3 weeks, 8 weeks, 9 months, doesn't matter. These are all human beings, and you have to consider their human dignity and their human life. So a couple of little things just to review, pop quiz. How many human beings have been cured with embryonic stem cells? Zero. How many with adult stem cells have been helped? Yep. You can use millions. We don't have a final estimate current, but I'd say it's over 2 million now. There are some federal restrictions, but not too many, on embryo destruction. The Dickey Wicker Amendment has been around for a while, and that just says you can't use federal funds to create and destroy human embryos. They keep trying to chip away at that, but it's kind of a thin little line that has held so far. But as they're moving ahead with some of these different ways to make embryos and not call them embryos, they keep trying to push that line aside. You actually can't patent a human organism now. Believe it or not, you could until 2011. 2015, the one I mentioned about no genetic engineering allowed with little human embryos. And I threw in the International Commission here because they actually called on a moratorium for that heritable germline engineering, but allowed that research should continue. So we really need to close all of these down. There are no bans on private or state funds. There are a few states that have limited some of the experiments that can be done on nascent human beings or that they can't be cloned. We never actually got those bills to pass here in Ohio, but we're going to keep trying. But the federal funds can still be used for those embryo models, wink, wink. And a little homework. Okay, I'm still being the professor here. But let me give you two homework assignments. Go to voyageoflife.com. Voyageoflife.com. And a couple of my colleagues put together this great detailed vision of from conception all the way to birth, including a lot of the things that happened to us during that time. They're great visuals, and okay, it's kind of corny, but if you just scroll down, you'll see the little embryo and the baby develop as you go. But also neat little things like, when did your taste buds develop? How early can you tell whether the baby will be left or right-handed? When does a baby start to experience pain in the womb, from what we already know from the science and so on? But check it out. Use it as a reference. Pass it around. Voyageoflife.com. And then this one, which is at LozierInstitute.org, L-O-Z-I-E-R, Institute.org. You'll have to search on handbook. But again, they put together, actually, it's a two-volume set, the Handbook of Nascent Human Beings, one talking about the science in an understandable way, with great pictures. So when somebody talks about cloning or embryo models or iPS cells and all of the scientific terms, it shows you what they're talking about. They're not going to slip one by you. And then the second volume is about the ethics. So look those up. Let me just end with this quote from Proverbs. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. And if you say, behold, we didn't know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not requite man according to his work? Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, David Prentice. We have got a lot of questions for you. Science class is something that not a lot of people like to take, but when they do, it's interesting. And you just gave us a master class on this. So we'll work our way through these in the 10 minutes. We have a full 10-minute period, too, so certainly appreciate that, too. Okay, UPMC Hospital System in Pittsburgh apparently ships tissues and organs from aborted babies to labs around the country. How can we respond to the argument that these samples are needed for research?
And we've been trying to hit them for a couple of years. It's in another state, so I don't know that you're going to have a direct effect. But you ought to be, number one, educating yourself about the reality of, is it needed or not? We've actually got another volume. I don't have the URL, but where we wrote a big, long paper, but it's accessible. We make it so you can understand the science that goes through all their claims that, hey, we need aborted baby hearts or livers or whatever, and just dismantles them, and then talks about the alternatives. Let me mention one in particular that's kind of a hot topic right now in scientific circles, humanized mice. You might have even heard this term, and we're not talking about Mickey Mouse, but we're talking about where they want to do experiments on, say, a human immune system, but they don't want to actually experiment on humans. Fancy that they would actually show some ethical sense. So what they do is they try and put a human immune system into a mouse to do those experiments. Now, in the past, they'd said, oh, we have to have fetal tissue. We have to have little baby livers, bone marrows, and something called a thymus gland. It's a little gland that helps train the immune system. We totally dismantled that argument and showed that there were other ways to do this using umbilical cord blood stem cells, using tissues after the baby was born and has gone through a surgery, let's say for a cardiac problem. Instead of throwing away those tissues, you can take those. One scientist actually showed you could make 50 times as many of these mice using the neonatal tissues and the cord blood after the baby's born, and it was actually more relevant in terms of a clinical model. It just beat them silly. So, again, there's an educational, there's a homework aspect here to find out. And, again, if you go to LozierInstitute.org and just search on fetal tissue, you'll find a whole bunch of references that you can argue those points and just dismantle those points in terms of it's necessary. The other thing I would suggest is contact your federal congresspeople, whether it's your rep or your senators, the ones that will listen, I know. There's some unevenness there. But, you know, and tell them about this. We've written letters for those congresspeople, but they need to be reminded that they need to keep on top of this. We've actually gotten to the point for Pittsburgh that they're under a little investigation by the Office of the Investigator General at NIH now, showing that you don't really need to do that.
All right, thank you. There's two separate ones here that are similar. They want to know about technology being used with stem cells. First one says, have they tried to regenerate limbs with stem cells? The second says, has the use of adult stem cells for treatment of burns become more widely spread? For example, a sprayable solution of cells.
Whole limbs, no, but they have used some adult stem cells to regenerate parts of skeletal muscle, for example, for veterans that have been injured, and that's worked pretty well. Still a work in progress, but they're moving ahead on that. In terms of burns, there have actually been some good results done with those, again, using cord blood or adult stem cells that they're starting to show good regeneration of nice, healthy skin, not the sort of scar tissue that you'd normally get.
Wonderful. Do you think it's more right to keep the millions of embryos, babies, frozen in this sort of limbo for who knows how long, or let them thaw and pass away? What do we do with them?
Yeah, and that's a really tough question. I know there's basically a division in religious circles, in bioethics circles. This is just my personal position, but I don't think you should thaw them and let them die. I don't think you should intentionally allow them to die. I think, for want of a better option, you keep them in the freezer until maybe somebody does adopt them, or maybe, you know, there's some sort of technological way to allow them a chance to grow and develop. And I know their opinions all over, but I see those as big kind of frozen orphanages, and I just don't see letting any little one die.
Okay. What is the alternative to vaccines derived from embryonic stem cell research, specifically pediatric vaccines?
Yeah, and that's a big problem. We actually did a whole survey when they were starting to develop all the various COVID vaccines. Fetal tissue tends to, or fetal cell lines, rather than embryonic, are usually the problem. There are a couple of old cell lines that were developed back in the 1960s and 70s. They're still using. The good news, that number of vaccines is decreasing. The bad news is it's not zero yet. And we have to keep pushing away at that. I will tell you that there are at least a couple of labs in the U.S., as well as one or two some other places, that are trying to come up with an alternative cell line, an ethically derived cell that will do the same or even better than those old aborted fetal cell lines. And you know, the virus or the vaccine companies actually realize that this isn't in their best interests. They're just not moving very fast. Sanofi, finally a few years ago, did away with using one of those old abortion-derived cell lines for their polio vaccine. So all the polio vaccines in the U.S. now are made with licit cell lines. But there are still a few, including the rubella vaccine, which then gets mixed in with the MMR. And we need to keep praying, number one, for these guys that are coming up with the alternatives. I would encourage you to contact, again, not just your federal legislators, contact these vaccine companies and say, you know, it would probably help your bottom line if you just got away from that, because you'd have a lot more people willing to accept their vaccines and medications if there wasn't this ethical taint.
You've been listening to Dr. David A. Prentice, scientific researcher, professor, and internationally recognized expert on stem cell research, cell biology, and bioethics, and our presenter at the 2024 Bringing America Back to Life convention. Thank you all for joining me this evening. As I say goodnight and God bless each and every one of you, I'd like to close with the words of the Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel. There may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there must never be a time when we fail to protest.
From the Median is listener supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our fromthemedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure, or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life.
This program has been sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.